The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
Well, now that the country is going to be opening up, what's ahead for all of us? And what are the risks of COVID-19 maybe coming back, a relapse, or coming back in the fall? Joining me on the program is ER Dr. Leslie Sharp. Leslie, when we had you on the program last time, there were so many questions and responses that we got that I wanted to have you back on the program. And I'd like to begin with some basics. You're in the ER, the front lines of this. And I guess a question I'd like to ask, and I'm sure many would like to know this, when you show up at the ER, how do you know whether you're dealing with someone with, let's say, just normal flu, pneumonia, or COVID-19? I guess would be one of the first questions. As a doctor, what are you looking for and how do you know?
Well, Jim, first of all, thank you for having me back as a guest once again. It's my pleasure to be here. The answer to your question, when someone shows up, we start off with screening everyone. Actually, in some ERs, you're screened even before you make it through the front doors. So the general questions are asked as far as what symptoms you have or what exposures you've had, potential exposures you've had to any COVID patients. People have already been diagnosed.
So do you have screening tests available now?
When you say, no, I'm talking about just verbal screening. So someone would meet you outside and ask you those questions and take your temperature at the same time.
And then if you are suspicious that this could be COVID-19, either they said they were around somebody or they're just giving you the symptoms, what would happen next?
So the next thing is they're brought into the emergency department if they have symptoms that are concerning. Now, that being said, there are many people who will come just saying that they have a cough, a fever, something very benign for which they would not need to be treated anyway. So people come into the emergency department expecting to be tested in the emergency department. Most places are not doing that.
So if you think it's more likely to be COVID-19, would you proceed with a test or have a test kit available so that maybe you could be definite?
It's different in different places, but if their symptoms are mild, in my particular location, we send people to a particular facility which tests them there. There are other places where you can be tested on site. I'm sure many people have seen the drive-throughs where they're testing people. Where I am, we send them to a particular location rather than potentially bringing people with mild symptoms into the emergency department and infecting other people.
So let's say somebody does have COVID-19. Leslie, how does the disease progress? What are the things that you see, number one, in terms of its progression? And number two, is it different for different individuals? In other words, people that have underlying conditions like diabetes, heart disease, obesity, other types of autoimmune diseases, lupus or something like that, would it be more severe for those type of people?
All right. To answer the first part of your question, people come in typically, number one presenting symptom is fevers. Then there's cough. They don't have an appetite. They're very tired. Those milder symptoms then progress to shortness of breath. The general body aches that you also see in normal flu, so to speak. That can then progress to that shortness of breath can change to their oxygen levels start to drop. They have more and more respiratory distress, which can lead to respiratory failure. And then all those other symptoms that go along with that, where you get sepsis, your body goes into shock, you can have inflammation of your heart called cardiomyopathy, irregular heart rhythms, and then multi-system organ failure progressing from that at the end stages. As far as people being affected, the people who are most at risk are exactly the people you mentioned. The people who have underlying heart disease, diabetes, COPD, asthma, of course, people who are already immunosuppressed, cancer, you mentioned lupus.
So if they have these underlying conditions, you know, we've heard there's various treatments out there. There's hydroxychloroquine with a Z-Pak. Gilead Science has a new drug that's been found effective that they've used with Ebola. Do you have, number one, access to those drugs? And number two, what would be the protocol to say, you know, this person is starting to go into distress? this is the time that we would give them those drugs, or is it more complicated than that?
It is definitely more complicated than that. So the evolution of treatment for COVID-19 is changing on a daily basis. Where we were saying, at first they were mentioning the chloroquine, the hydroxychloroquine with the Z-Pak, that has now fallen out of favor completely. So there are a lot of other things that are rapidly developing, and one of those includes something called, and I'm hoping I even pronounce it properly, tocilizumab. And what that is that stops that cytokine storm that you may have heard about and works very quickly and is so far in studies proving to be effective. Now, that being said, there is no FDA approved treatment or prophylactic prevention for COVID-19. Not at all.
So given the fact, like, let's say this disease is progressing, you're getting that storm that you talked about, the patient is having a hard time breathing, when would a decision be made to possibly use any of those options as a possible solution versus, you know, they go on the respirator and maybe you can answer this question. By the time they get to the respirator, in many cases, they end up dying.
That is very true. So one of the things, that once a patient is admitted, they generally watch for the progression. Now, there are some people who are admitted with that shortness of breath. Their oxygen saturation is low, not critically low, but low. They don't need to be intubated yet. And they just watch to see if things are getting worse, better, or staying the same. So that can actually last for several days. If the patient starts to get worse, then they're going to think about adding these additional medications.
And Leslie, are those medications easily available or are they difficult to get?
They're difficult to get at this point because they are limited availability. However, as I said, there's multiple different ones that they're trying. So different ones may be available at different places. I can tell you at my hospital, they are actually working with several of these medications and have had success, although these are isolated cases, but so far they are having good success.
And could you put a probability of success on that?
It's too early to do that.
Okay.
It really is, because there haven't been enough people that have been treated.
And can you tell me why hydroxychloroquine has fallen out of favor? Because we've seen patients that have had this miraculous recovery and they have them on TV. With hydroxychloroquine, you had the French study where they had 100% success ratio. And then there's the one doctor in New York, I can't think of his name, where he had close to 700 patients. So why has this fallen out of favor?
Well, the information that I've received are from several infectious disease doctors that are working with us this on a daily basis. And I think part of it has to do with the potential side effects of the hydroxychloroquine.
And the side effects being worse than the cure? I mean, what's the possible risk, if I may ask?
Well, not worse than the cure. Obviously, the cure would be the ideal. But I think that in a lot of cases, it has been used almost before it's necessary, before it's needed. And so people who have underlying heart disease, for example, it is causing great risk to them. Whereas some of these other medications that are coming along, I should say they're not new medications. They're medications that have been used for other things, such as remdesivir, which started out being used for Ebola, and it stops the viral replication. So by doing that, you are not risking the side effects of potential cardiac injury. But at the same time, as I said, they're getting good results so far.
And so given the patient's condition, let's say they come in, you're doing questioning, you find out they have heart disease, or maybe they're diabetic, or they have some autoimmune disease, then that would sort of in the back of your mind start giving you some, if this progresses worse or it gets worse, then you would maybe use one of those drugs?
Correct.
You said some of these drugs are not as available. Are they making efforts, if they're finding something that works, are they getting enough supplies? Like, I know at one time the president intervened and several drug companies from Bayer to Teva were sending hydroxychloroquine to the U.S. So if there is a shortage, Is it being ameliorated?
My understanding is that it is. As I said, a lot of these medications are already available. One of the difficulties is some of them are at a very high cost. So they're trying to find other means. And one of the other means that they're finding successful as well is plasma. So I'm not sure how much your listeners are aware, but for patients that have already had corona, COVID-19, passed through, done well, and recovered, they're collecting their plasma, and that those plasma donations can be given to people who are quite ill on the ventilators, and they are seeing wonderful turnarounds with plasma donations.
Leslie, one of the things we hear from television broadcast and in the news that one of the things that makes this difficult is it's asymptomatic. In other words, you may be walking around and carrying it and not even know it. In fact, there was a study that I think came out of, I'm not sure if it was UCLA, there was thought to be 8,000 infections, and it turns out there's been 400,000. So there's a lot of people walking around that have had it or been exposed to it, and they don't even know.
Absolutely. And that's what makes it so dangerous, because without everyone across the board being tested, you don't know who has it and who doesn't. And for people to get back to, I'm going to say, normalcy in the country, and think that you can then start to congregate and not have to worry about it because you feel fine and they feel fine, you can still be passing it on from one person to another, and then in turn, take that back home to your elderly relative, to someone who has these underlying problems. And whereas you're asymptomatic, you've now exposed them to it, and they're at extreme risk.
You know, one of the things that I guess I want to go to next is, as they open up the country, because if they keep it shut down, you know, the cure could be worse, because in other words, it could put the economy into a Great Depression. So they're anxious to open up the economy in different phases. I'm not sure how this is all going to work out, if it's going to be different phases for different locations or states. So let's talk about that recovery. So we come out of this, they begin to open up the economy. But as you mentioned, you know, we're probably going to be changing our behavior. We're hearing things like, you go to the store, they've got plastic shields in front of checkers at the grocery store. We're going to be doing things differently. So let's talk about, if this opens up, how we keep safe, because this hasn't gone away. We don't have a vaccine, and we don't have an absolute cure yet that you can say, here's the pill that does it.
First of all, have to reiterate what has already been said as far as hand washing, as far as the masks, which are now recommended for everyone. Anytime you sneeze or cough, people think, oh, it's just a few droplets that spread locally. The force of a cough itself can actually project droplets up to 27 feet.
My goodness.
So we're all thinking about that 6 feet, but it can spread that far. Now, something as simple as having a mask on obviously is going to reduce that significantly. And that's where we want to impress upon people the hand washing, general hygiene. If you are sick, not to go out in public in the first place, even with a mask on. And of course, even though you're asymptomatic, think about not only yourself, but everyone around you, and wear that mask.
What about gloves?
So gloves are a tricky thing, because it gives people a false sense of security. If you put on gloves and then you're walking around outside with gloves and you're touching areas that have already been contaminated, and then you're touching other things because you feel you're safe, you're still spreading things from your hands just as if you had no gloves on at all. And then you think about it, and you wear gloves too long, and then you go scratch your face, scratch your nose, anything like that. You're then putting that right back onto yourself. So in some instances, you can say that they're good to have, but it gives people a false sense of security if they're not really in tune with how to wear them and when to wear them.
Yeah, I didn't think about that. I think, I have gloves on, so I'm protected. I'm not getting anything on my hands. But if I touch something that's been infected and then touch something else, I'm really spreading it.
Exactly.
So let's take an average business, people going back to the office. How is that going to work? Do you think we'll have to go back to the office with gloves or masks on? Or how do you think that's going to play out?
I think in some places, they may start off doing shifts where you have a certain number of employees coming in at any given time. So you're still minimizing crowding, so to speak. That might be one solution. And this is just some ideas that have been thrown out. I can tell you most places will probably want you to have your temperature checked when you come in. I can tell you that's the first thing when you come into the emergency department or into the hospital at all, is they check every employee's temperature.
Yeah, one of the things that we've been thinking about is getting those temperatures. What's that device where you point it towards the forehead and you can pick up the temperature?
The thermal scanners.
Yeah, and then also mask, because we're thinking of shift work. And what else do we need to be aware of? So in other words, even though they open it up, I suspect what you're going to tell our listeners is they should still, going out in public, you know, because we think during the summer, you're not thinking of flu season in the middle of July. You're thinking of, you know, 4th of July parties, being at the beach or taking a vacation. So do you think until we get a vaccine, we're going to be living in a world where what we're doing now at home we'll be doing out in public?
I do think that things are going to change, most definitely. I think that during the summer, things may ease up some. As you said, flus typically aren't as active during the summer months, during the warmth. But if we're not conscientious of how we act, as soon as the fall comes, we will have another peak very quickly.
And usually, until you have a vaccine, we know every single year, we have a flu season. Depending on how bad it is, we normally experience anywhere from 30 to 60,000. I think, I'm not sure, you probably know this, 2018 was a bad season, or 2017, I forget which year, but we lost 60,000 people due to flu.
Yes, I believe that was 2017.
So given this, the fact that we, at the moment, we don't have a vaccine, number two, we don't have a cure. In other words, some kind of pill that works for everybody. What are the chances that until we have that vaccine, this is life as we know it is going to be different? In other words, I don't think you'll see people sitting right next to each other in a movie theater, or, you know, 70,000 fans in a stadium watching an NFL game.
I agree with you. I just don't see that as a wise thing to do. Our lives have changed. We have to adapt with that, overcome it.
And what about, you know, the businesses? You know, I was thinking of who's going to go to a gym now when you think of every piece of equipment you touch at the gym. I don't care if it's treadmill, if it's barbells, dumbbells, weights. You just see certain businesses that are really going to be impacted this and may not survive. And even think about restaurants. Restaurants, I've heard there was a story in the Wall Street Journal where some restaurants are thinking of maybe having less crowded spaces, putting plastic kind of shields between booths so that you can shield people from other people. But it sounds like life as we know it is going to be so much different going forward. And there may be some businesses that basically don't survive.
And that's the unfortunate part about it all. I know that a lot of restaurants around me, for example, are offering takeout, but there's some restaurants, takeout is just not something that they can do and still provide the same quality. And that is the very sad part about it. I know I personally try to take out as often as I can, even though it's not necessarily the healthiest thing to do all the time, but I'm trying, as even for myself, to keep these restaurants afloat, even if I'm just one person. And it is very sad. And I don't know that there's a good alternative to that. Those plastic sheets around might be very helpful, but there's no guarantees.
And you even think of cinema. I heard one cinema is thinking of basically spacing people. In other words, before the movie starts, they will only sell so many tickets. They'll make sure they'll have, just as used to have ushers, they would basically go up and down the aisles. But boy, you just, it's hard to believe, Leslie, less than 2 months ago, we had the lowest unemployment. The economy was doing well. Everybody was doing well. We were watching football games. Life was normal. And look how much life has changed in just a short time span.
Just the blink of an eye.
You know, what makes this so different from, let's say, SARS, MERS, Ebola? I mean, SARS isn't even around anymore, I understand. And Ebola, we came out with something to fight it. What makes this so different?
Because of the virulence of it, it is spread so easily. And that's what makes the difference. And the fact that if you have something like Ebola where there are very little period where you're asymptomatic, it hits you fast. For this, if you have so many people that are asymptomatic, the spread is so easy because you just don't know.
Well, as you mentioned, I never thought of it. You know, I think when I go out, I have a copper-infused mask on. I have copper gloves with latex underneath, and I think I'm safe. But as you mentioned, everything I'm touching with my hands, if there's the virus on whatever I touch it, get it on my hands, touch something else, and I spread it.
Exactly, which is why anything that, when you go to the grocery store, for example, when you get your items home, wash them. We don't think about that on a regular, we think about washing our fruits and vegetables before we eat them anyway. But the idea is clean everything. Act as if, I don't want people to be paranoid, but act as if anything could potentially be contaminated.
And so going forward, the one thing you're going to tell everybody, as you did the last time we had you on, and one of the most important things you could do, wash your hands, keep your hands away from your face, and going out in public, you should be wearing a mask.
Absolutely. All the time.
Anything else that you were seeing in the medical profession, talking to epidemiologists or peers in the field, treatments that you could add?
Well, those are the treatments that I have knowledge of firsthand at this point. Now, keep in mind, in the emergency department, we're not starting any of these treatments. So these are started once you're admitted to the hospital. Only other thing that I would add is the hope that there is more widespread testing for what we call IgG and IgM, which are antibody testing, because as that comes out, you'll be able to tell who has already been exposed and is past the infectious stage, and therefore we know that they can confer that immunity to others through things like the plasma donations.
And I guess the final thing is, it's my understanding there's over 300 companies that are working on a vaccine. Johnson & Johnson has announced that it is working on trials, at-risk trials this fall. And if they're successful, they hope to be making a, I don't know, what is it, somewhere in the neighborhood of a billion vaccines a year. What are the chances? I've been told that vaccines take at least 12, 15, 18 months. What are the chances, given the virulence of this, that they speed this up? When you have over 300 and something companies, given our technology today, that we come up with a vaccine this time sooner rather than later?
I sure hope so. I really do. There are pluses and minuses to speeding things up. Of course, you want to make sure that there aren't any side effects for these medications before they're distributed to the public. So that's one of the major things. And of course, everything requires FDA approval. So until they meet those certain guidelines, it can only go so fast.
All right. Well, listen, doctor, I want to thank you for coming on the program. Great information. So if there were just one, two, or three things you would leave our listeners with, what would that be?
I would definitely say keep washing your hands, wear that mask, and be conscious of what's going on around you. Don't think just because you're asymptomatic that you can't potentially be a carrier and still cause harm to others. So we've got to use our minds and think about things before we do them.
All right. Well, doctor, thanks so much. You have a pleasant evening and stay safe, as once again, you're on the front line. So you're exposed to more to this than most of us. So stay safe.
Thank you so much. You too.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.